Hi everyone, I'm David Turner and I work for the Free Software Foundation. Most of the time, my job is to keep free software free by enforcing the GPL. But I also do some development on future versions of the GPL and a bunch of other licensing issues. So while I was researching licensing, I came upon this idea of trusted computing and gave it some thought and came up with some ideas. So here's what I'm going to talk about. These paradoxes of choice, where you can have fewer choices but more freedom. How that relates to illegally copying software, movies, that sort of thing, which I'm sure none of you have ever done. Law enforcement, how that fits in. And finally, what can be done about trusted computing and what should be done. But first I'm going to show you a picture of a monkey. So there are these cases where you can have fewer choices. That is, you can be forbidden by law or because you don't have the capabilities, the money, whatever it is, from doing something and actually end up with more freedom. This is kind of weird. Usually you think of laws as being enforced against other people. We have a law against murder not because we're afraid that if there were not such a law, we'd go out and kill a bunch of people, but instead that we're afraid that people would go out and kill us. But there are some cases where you want laws to be applied against yourself. Here's a great example of this. Back in the 1970s, a lot of the Arab countries would say, we're not going to do business with companies who do business with Israel. So Pepsi was actually benefited by a law made in the United States that said that they could not comply with those laws. That is, if a company said, you can't do business with country X, then you can't do business with that country. And the reason is that Arab countries now had a choice. They could say, either we're going to not have Pepsi at all, or we're going to get rid of our laws that require Pepsi not to do business with Israel if they're doing business with us. So this law that restricts Pepsi's freedom to trade in these countries that have these laws actually ends up benefiting Pepsi. Another cool example of this is compulsory voting, where you're required to vote. Now, ordinarily, you might want to not vote. Maybe you want to protest against the system. Maybe you don't like any of the choices, whatever it is. But there are cases where you might want to be required to vote, and that's when you would otherwise be forbidden. In Afghanistan, there's a very real problem where the treatment of women is just absolutely terrible, even today. And so what's happening is, for voting, which actually just happened 3 or 4 days ago, I think they're still counting the ballots. A lot of men would say, well, we're not going to let our wives vote, which they could do because they had all the power in the situation. If in Afghanistan there were a law that required people to vote, and there isn't, but I propose that there ought to be, that would not be a possibility anymore. Again, a law that restricts your freedom ends up giving you more options. So,
oops, that's a previous, not a next. That's next. So, we have this system where it's really easy to illegally copy software, movies, music. And people want to prevent this in various ways. So, up through the mid-80s, there was this technical escalation going on, where you create a new technology for copying things, such as a personal computer or a VCR. And there would be a corresponding anti-copying technology introduced. The original Macrovision, which prevents you from copying VHS tapes, at least in theory, was introduced as a response to the VCR. That's after the movie companies tried and failed to kill the VCR in court. Likewise, in computer software, this was huge during the 1980s. There was just a back and forth between people who created new ways to copy things and new ways to stop them. You know, bad sectors on floppy disks, incredibly complex cryptography, that sort of thing. Whoops. I'm not used to this browser, excuse me. So, in about 1995, the internet really started taking off. And the internet is a gigantic machine for copying things. And this scared a whole lot of people who are in the business of restricting copying. So for DVDs, they created the content scrambling system. And this is pretty far-sighted for the movie industry. 1996, I think they've seen farther than they see today. to where you can copy movies easily off the internet if you have the bandwidth, and that's increasingly available. So throughout the late 90s, there was this progression of new laws and new countermeasures. A good example of this is Napster was created. And Napster is a completely new technology for copying music. At its heart, it's really simple. But no one had the bandwidth before, so no one thought to create the technology. And, of course, Napster doesn't actually do any of the copying. It's just HTTP, the same thing as the web underneath. But what it does is lets you find things. That was shut down in 2000. But even in 1999, the writing was on the wall. The legal theory under which Napster was shut down was not widely known about. It's called contributory infringement. The idea is you're not actually infringing copyright. Instead, you're helping other people infringe copyright. And you know that you're helping them. And you could stop them from infringing copyright, which Napster ultimately decided to do. And I think they're now in the business of selling music. So the wise people over at Nullsoft, which now a division of AOL, decided we're going to get rid of one of those three elements, the we can do something about it element. And they created a completely decentralized system called GNUtella, no relation to the GNU project, which worked pretty well, given that it hardly worked at all. That is to say, technically it wasn't very good. A lot of the later systems have been a lot better, but legally it actually worked. In the Grokster case, same technology, the court said, well, because you can't do anything about it, then we can't make you shut down the system. So this was actually a successful technical attack on a legal attack on the system of copying music. Since then, we've had a whole lot of new laws proposed. I've got a few of them listed here. This is just only the ones in the United States. There have been a lot more worldwide and a lot of treaties that the United States has made with people. The really big one that very nearly passed was the Consumer Broadband and Digital Television Promotion Act, CBDTPA, which would have criminalized technologies like, the World Wide Web, that sort of thing, little technologies that no one ever uses, and fortunately failed. These laws are going to keep being introduced, and people are going to have to keep fighting them, because they do criminalize a lot more than they are aimed at. So the question is, why does this all happen? Oops, wrong button again. And the answer is that data is really special, right? Anything that matters in terms of data can be represented as a stream of bits. Now, maybe there's some analog data out there that's, too fine-grained to represent as bits, but that data doesn't really matter because it's not stuff that people really care about copying. That is, movies, music, and software. And the funny thing about computers is that they're machines for processing data. And if you can read data, you can copy it. And if you can copy it, you can copy and change it. So everything that a computer knows about the world is data. And everything about the computer world that the computer knows can be modified. So it's really easy to lie to your computer. And if your computer thinks, well, maybe they haven't made a copy, you think, well, we're just lying to the computer and tell them we haven't made a copy. In fact, we have. So as a result of this, we have a failure of the technology for preventing copying. Certainly all technology on an ordinary PC is based on the idea that there's some data and it's either hard to copy or it's encrypted. But if you can read it, you can copy it. So a lot of these copy prevention technologies, are aimed at preventing you from reading the data. They'll put bad sectors on a floppy disk, or they'll require a special player for stuff. But of course, that data has to get shown to you somehow, and so you have to be able to read it. So given that these technical means have completely and utterly failed, companies have moved on to law enforcement. And the idea of this is, Well, we're going to find people who are copying stuff, and we're going to sue them. Now, if you're giving floppy disks or CDs to your friends, there's no way they're going to find you. But if you're a company and you're using illegally copied software, then one day one of your employees is going to say, hey, I'm not getting paid what I deserve. Or, hey, I had a really bad day. My boss was really mean to me. I'm going to turn them in. And in fact, if you talk to the Business Software Alliance, which is a group of proprietary software manufacturers, including, say, Microsoft, they'll tell you that most of the time when they go after companies for illegally copying their software, it's because those companies were turned in by their employees. So that works really well in the business world. But it doesn't work at all in the home world. And just as an aside here, it turns out that, in fact, as evidence for how it works, if you look at where the greatest rates of illegally copied software are, it's not the companies that have the greatest technical prowess, that are the best at breaking these copy prevention systems. Instead, it's the countries that have the weakest law enforcement, like, say, China. And if you walk down the streets in Shanghai, as I did 2 weeks ago, you'll find little vendors on the street, and they're selling CDs of anything you want for a dollar, or DVDs of anything you want, even things that aren't out yet on DVD, for a dollar. So this law enforcement system is going to keep working for companies, because as long as there are employees, there are going to be disgruntled employees. But for individuals, there have been these very mixed results. On one hand, there are a bunch of high-profile prosecutions. You hear about the people at Princeton University, for instance, getting these huge, massive fines. And now you hear about record companies going after people for sharing music on Kazaa. And this actually has had some success. That is, immediately after the first wave of peer-to-peer file-sharing prosecutions against users were announced, file-sharing traffic, that like the week after, dropped something like 40%, according to the Pew Internet Project. So is this sustainable? I think it's probably not. And some people at Microsoft, interestingly enough, agree with me. They wrote a paper called Darknet, which suggests that as long as you've got this public peer-to-peer system where you're trading with people and sharing with people that you don't know, some of those people that you don't know are going to be moles for the recording industry. But when you're just sharing with your friends, you know your friends, you trust your friends, and your friends probably aren't going to turn you in. So the future of this is small group file sharing, which sounds like it's going to be kind of a shame because the huge libraries of stuff that are out there now won't be available. But the flip side of this is that we now have these massive hard drives. I now have more memory for my digital camera than 10 years ago I had on my desktop computer, hard drive, and that's pretty impressive. So you're going to be able to have 1,000 movies on your desktop. In fact, I think I probably already can have 1,000 movies on my desktop if I were so inclined. Now, just a quick question. How many of you would buy a computer if only a few companies could make software for it? Raise your hand. All right, how many of you have bought a PlayStation? Raise your hand. PlayStation 2, Xbox, none of you? Not a single one? There's one. Hi, Jack. Yeah, that's a computer that only a few companies can make software for. And they're wildly popular. So, these limited computers are another possible response to this sort of copying. Law enforcement, it doesn't really work. Technical measures, don't really work, at least the ones that are based in software. So what about this? We'll create new hardware that won't let you access the data. And because you can't access the data, you can't copy the data. You can't modify the data. And game consoles have actually been significantly more successful in this field than computers have. But even so, all of their hardware systems have been cracked, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later. This is not actually something that's going to spread to PCs, the idea that only a few people can make software for your computer. And the reason it's not going to spread to PCs is Because when you describe it that way to people, it sounds like basically the most horrible thing possible. It's a destruction of the free market. Well, as free as the market is. And it means that you're going to have this really limited selection of software. The reason people like PCs is because they've got a huge selection of software out there. So what if you could only go halfway, have something that's limited, but also general purpose? And this is what the Trusted Computing Group was thinking, our friends at IBM and HP, Microsoft, a few other companies. They were thinking, well, we're going to have this system that's general purpose computing, but we're going to limit a few things you can do on it. And there are two mechanisms here. There's trusted boot and remote attestation, which I'll tell you about in just a second. But first, someone's actually come up with this limited and general thing before. There's a game called Gnomic, which was invented by Peter Suber, a philosophy professor at Earlham University, in his book, The Paradox of Self-Amendment. And the idea is, it's a game of making rules, which makes it pretty weird to play. And he invented this game in order to explore the idea that you can have a system of laws where some of the laws can be changed and some of the laws can't be changed, but which laws can be changed and can't be changed can be changed. And it does lead to some sort of fascinating paradoxes. The computing implementation of which is trusted computing. So a trusted computer is a computer that operates the way that the person who's trusting it expects it to operate. Now, the person trusting your computer in the trusted computing model might not actually be you. It might, but it might not. And the way it works is a piece of hardware, because, well, it's pretty easy to make software change the way software works. It's a little harder to change the way hardware works. So you've got this chip called the Trusted Platform Manager. And what's inside the chip, the idea is that the chip is tamper-resistant. It's hard to figure out what's going on in there. There is a private key, which is secret from everyone in the world. Nobody knows what it is. Not the computer manufacturer, and definitely not you. There are a bunch of registers, that's platform configuration registers. These are volatile. They go away when the machine gets turned off. And then there are some cryptographic operations that can be performed. The idea is not to be a general-purpose cryptographic coprocessor. This isn't actually particularly fast or anything. The idea is that you've got this chip that can sign things with this private key, and the chip's certificate is signed by its manufacturer. Now, what does this get you? Well, one thing it gets you is trusted boot, which is a way of booting your computer that builds up a chain of trust such that you trust that your computer is in a certain state. Now, a certain state means that this software is loaded and no other software that can interfere with the machine's operation in any way is loaded. For instance, debuggers, viruses, Trojans, whatever it is. So how does that work? Well, PCRs, the platform configuration registers, can only be updated by using their update function. And what that does is it takes a new value, concatenates it with the old value, hashes the result, and puts that back in the PCR. So when your computer boots up under this trusted boot sequence, the first stage bootloader gets measured, which is trusted computing speak for cryptographically hashed. And that hash is updated onto the first PCR, which is initially in this known state. Now, the reason this update functionality works like this, the reason you can't just put anything in there, is so that you can trust that things were put in a certain order and that only the things that you think are in there are in there. So the first stage bootloader measures, that is, cryptographically hashes, the second stage, etc. And all of this goes into your PCRs until your entire operating system is loaded. When your operating system has to do something that depends on trust, like, for instance, if your hard drive is encrypted and you want no one to be able to read your hard drive with alternate software, for instance, you don't want someone to install a Trojan horse such that it captures your keystrokes or sends your data to the FBI, that sort of thing. You can do that. So there's this functionality here called seal, where you seal some data. And what that does is it encrypts the data, or more accurately, a key which encrypts the data. And with the encrypted key, it uses the chip's public key to do this, it stores the platform configuration registers. And remember that only this chip has the private key. So if you want to get back to the data, you have to talk to the chip. And the chip will refuse to decrypt the key unless your system is in the same state. That is, the PCRs have the same value. So now you can say, if someone installs some new software on my computer, they replace my C library with a C library that sends all my data across the internet or that provides a backdoor into my system, then because my system will be in a different state, I will not be able to read any of my data. And I'll know immediately that something's wrong. The other neat thing that trusted computing provides is the same thing, but remotely. So you can prove that your system is in a certain state, is running certain software and only certain software to someone else across the internet. And you don't have to do this, right? You can always say, I'm not telling you what software I'm running. But what you can't do is lie to them. And the way that works is that they send you a nonce, just a random value, so that they know that you're doing this online. And your chip, that is your trusted platform manager, takes that random value, concatenates with it with the PCRs, signs the result, and sends it out. Now, remember that your key in your PCR is signed by the manufacturer. So you know that you passed that manufacturer signature on, and now you're saying something provided by manufacturer X, which, according to manufacturer X, works in a certain way. That is, we trust that it works in a certain way, has told me that it is running this set of software. And if you know what that set of software is that's represented by those PCRs, then you know what the system is going to do when you send it some data. So what's this useful for? What it's useful for, I got a couple of things here that are crossed out. These are things that people have told us that it's useful for, but it's not actually useful for. So the first one is that it's security against your software replacement attack, where you put in a Trojan horse. And I've just jumped the gun and discussed that. And this is a genuine, legitimate security use. It's not something that's in any way sneaky or anything. It's an unalloyed good thing. The next thing is these reusable proofs of work. This is pretty neat. So a guy named Hal Finney, I think he's a professor probably at Princeton, they're all at Princeton, has this technology for preventing spam, which it's not original to him, but the implementation and the use of trusted computing is. The generic term for this is hashcash. The idea is you want to prove that your computer has done a certain amount of work so that people know that you're not sending out a million emails a day. Because if you were, you'd have to have a computer that could do a lot of work. The reason they call it hashcash is because it's usually implemented by reverse hashes. You have to find a value which hashes to a value that you're given, or that matches a certain number of bits of that. So in the reusable proofs of work system, you can get a value between 20 and 50 bits. And, of course, each is twice as hard to find as the next. So a 25-bit thing is 32 times as hard to find as a 20-bit thing. And you give these to some, you include one of these with your email. And the person who receives your email then goes back to Hal's server and says, hey, is this a genuinely, proof of work that hasn't been used yet? And Hal's server will say yes or no. So why do you trust that Hal's server is not in league with the spammers? Either the spammers have broken into it, because there's nothing that people won't stop at who want to send spam. Or maybe Hal's just sold out. Or maybe they've held him at gunpoint. I don't know. And the answer is that the IBM 4758 cryptographic processor has the equivalent of trusted computing in it. It's got a function where it will tell you the hash of what software it's running. And he's gone and published this software on the net. So you've got this need to trust it, and now you've got a mechanism by which you can trust it. And this looks like it's going to be really good for trusted computing, because it's a use for it that doesn't involve, you know, stepping all over your rights and that sort of thing. But I think that it is not actually a genuine case for trusted computing. So the reason you've got to trust, the reason that Hal has to convince you to trust his server is because no one uses it right now. His goal is to get adoption, because, of course, if no one adopts the system, it's not going to do any good in fighting spam. And you've got all the power. You can choose to take this or leave it. You can just be perfectly happy with Spam Assassin, SPF, Razor, whatever the latest anti-spam thing is. You don't have to use this. If you imagine, though, that there's some future situation, right, where this becomes incredibly popular, such that no one will accept your email when you send out your resume to get a job, when you contact your girlfriend. No one will accept your email if you're not using this system, which, after all, is the only way it's going to work in terms of actually fighting spam, is if at least a significant portion of the internet adopts it. Now, in this case, why do you trust that it's not working with the spammers? Well, you've still got this trusted computing thing. But what if he just turns that feature off? He says, I'm sorry, I no longer feel any need for you to trust me. You can trust me or you can not trust me. See if I care. Then you have to trust him, because you have to keep using the system. Now all of a sudden, he's got the power. So I think this is probably not a good use for trusted computing. Another case that people have considered, this is from Rachel Greenstadt and, sorry, I can't remember the name of her co-author. The idea is medical privacy. So you've got some horrible disease, and you don't want your boss to find out about it because your boss will fire you. And you don't want your friends to find out about it because in society there's some stigma against people who have this disease, whatever it is. So the first problem here is, how are you going to convince all of the hospitals you go to, right? You're one person here. You've got these, you know, huge hospitals, medical organizations. This is probably less of a problem in Europe than it is in the United States, because I think you have better laws here and a better healthcare system altogether. But in the United States, it's huge. The companies that provide your medical care are vastly more powerful than you, vastly more wealthy than you, and they hold all the cards, because if you're lucky enough to have medical insurance in the first place, they tell you which doctors you can go to. They tell you which surgeons. They tell you which drugs you can and can't take. You have no choice but to trust them. So one solution to this is you can have medical privacy laws. And they've had them in Europe for years. But in the United States, it's pretty recent. I think it's called HIPAA, which healthcare providers something or other. And they say you've got to use technology that attempts to protect people's medical privacy, which is cool. But what kind of technology? So Rachel Greenstadt has suggested, let's use trusted computing here. So if you end up in some state, you're normally from New York and you end up in California, right? And you break your arm. You go to the doctor in California and say, I broke my arm. And your doctor says, well, let me look up your medical records. Your doctor back in New York won't send those records unless you give approval. And trusted computing can control what happens to them after they get onto the computer of the doctor in California. So that doctor can't go ahead and, you know, send them to his friends and laugh at them, that sort of thing, post them on the internet, whether on purpose or by accident. So trusted computing is going to work in terms of preventing accidents, that is, preventing, preventing user errors or preventing hackers. But what it's not going to work at is the doctor is just going to go tell his friends, if you're especially a famous person, and there's something seriously wrong with you. You know, it's always in the news, celebrity X has cancer, that sort of thing. And until we get trusted computing for our brains, there's nothing that's going to stop the doctor from telling us that. So one thing you can do, this is a puzzle from the game of Myst, I think. Either that or it's a shrine. One thing you can do with trusted computing, and this is the one that really everyone's afraid of, is that you can prevent copying. And what you prevent copying of is kind of an interesting question, and we'll get to that in a second. So the steps here are simple. You've got a trusted boot. Your computer boots up into a known state. And then your computer runs this media manager. These guys here in bold, these next three steps, require internet access. But the neat thing about it is that playing media, so getting the media, requires internet access. This is going to only work for data that's delivered over the internet. It's not going to work for stuff that you get on CD or DVD. And it doesn't have to be over the internet. I could do a postal implementation of this. There's no reason you can't do remote implementation by, remote attestation by snail mail. It really would work. It's just that it would be too slow to be worth bothering with. So you say, your computer says to the media server, okay, I'm in a state where the media manager is running and there's not a debugger running in the background, that sort of thing. Send me some media. And the distributor sends the media, at which point the media manager seals the media to this configuration. And remember that sealed data can only be open when the system is in the configuration that it was in when the data was sealed. So when your system goes to unseal the media and, say, share it with a friend, if the media manager isn't running and doing the unsealing, then it simply won't work. You won't have the decryption key. Now the neat thing about this is that while you do need to be on the internet to download the media, whatever it is, and the keys, you don't need to be on the internet to play it. You can play it anytime you want, when you're on the road, whatever. So when I say media, it doesn't sound so bad if we had to go back to, 1984 when copying meant, sharing audio tapes with your friends. That wouldn't be the end of the world. But what if you couldn't send a news story to your friend? Or even save a copy of a news story for more than a few days? A lot of newspapers, at least in the United States, have a policy where you're welcome to read them online for a week. But after that, you have to pay them $2 or $3 or whatever it is to view a single article. And access to the history of news media is critically important for a free society. You've got to be able to find out what your politicians said, when they said it, and what they actually did. And if you can't save this data, it's really easy to rewrite history. Another use for this is corporate data. Now, if you're running a corporation, you probably don't want people to be sharing your corporate data out over the internet. The Free Software Foundation is kind of an odd exception here. Our idea is that you ought to be able to share stuff. But even we don't want you to know our, medical records, our healthcare, that sort of thing. But actually being able to make that choice yourself as an employee is relatively important. If your company is doing something wrong, let's say it's operating a chemical plant in India which is going to explode, or a nuclear power plant that is being run unsafely, you want to be able to get that out there. And if, because of this trusted computing, secure boot, and remote attestation process, you can't do that, well, that's everybody's loss. But what this relies on here is essential network services. So trusted computing depends on having these networks. If there's a network service that you're not depending on to get the data or otherwise use, then trusted computing is powerless to stop you from doing things with it. Because you can always lie to your computer, you just can't lie to other people's computer when they're giving you the data. So some systems have actually already started using this concept of an essential network service to reduce copying. Now, the major two cases I can think of for this are the TiVo, which is a home hard drive recorder for television, and games. And the way a TiVo works is that you need to be able to get the TV listings. And so you're paying them $10 a month or whatever it costs. I don't know. I don't have one. For the privilege of getting this network data. And as long as there's some network service here, they can do remote attestation and control a whole lot more than just your access to the network service. So some future version of TiVo might say, well, we don't want you to modify the software that's running on there, even though a lot of it is actually free software, or at least used to be. So we're going to say, if you're using a modified version of our software, we're not going to give you access via this essential network service. The other example, of course, is games. Quake, for instance. Sure, you can play it single player, but what you really want is to play it over the network. And to do that, you have to contact id Software servers and give them an ID. And if two people give them the same ID, well, they get cut off. So why this is possible is because of this power relationship. The only time remote attestation works as a mechanism for giving you trust in a system is when the thing you want to trust is the behavior of a computer rather than the behavior of the computer's users. Until we get chips in our brain, you can't control the behavior of a computer's users, only the behavior of their computers. And you also have to have some sort of power over the owner of the computer, which means that you have something that they want, whether that's something that is a piece of data or a service or totally essential healthcare, whatever it is, you have to be in a position of power. Because if you're not, people are just going to refuse to attest to you what they're running. If I ask you, excuse me, are you running Windows there? You'd have every right to say, just absolutely say, none of your business, because I'm not in a position of power here. I just have the microphone. So there are these network effects that come up where, hold on just a second. These network effects that come up where it's a lot harder to avoid being part of one of these systems where other people have power over you if everyone else is doing it. And this is in part economic and in part psychological. Everybody else is running Windows. Why aren't you running Windows? Is there something wrong with you? And you hear that a lot. So it's hard to resist an installed base. A great example of this is Flash, the system for annoying animations on the web. In my past life, I worked for a web design company, and the assumption that the company made was that everyone had Flash or would be willing to install it in order to see these, you know, people jumping around or whatever it was for our corporate clients who are making skincare cream. And this, when you talk to the designers, they're like, yes, of course, everyone has Flash. I had kind of a hard time occasionally because I refused to use Flash, not only because it's proprietary software, but because it's absolutely mind-bogglingly annoying. I love it when you're browsing a web page and something jumps up. Hey, want to buy something? That's great. That really makes my web browsing experience. But apparently 90% of people think that that really is a good idea. And so the number actually it was something like 90% of users and like 97% of Windows users have Flash installed. But when something's first starting off, right, it's easy to say no. The virtual reality modeling language. And anyone remember that one back from, what was the movie called? Lawnmower Man? I think they were trying to make the web look like Lawnmower Man. No one installed it because they're like, I don't want Lawnmower Man. What I want is to read stuff. I want text. I want pictures. I don't want my computer to run really slowly so you can show me these, crappy flat shaded, virtual environments. So, it's important when you're dealing with a technology that you know is going to suck to tell all your friends not to use it before it becomes popular. The other thing with trusted computing, right, is that it's got a really fabulously great name. Why aren't you running trusted computing? Don't you want to trust your computer? Don't you want your computer to be secure? What's wrong with trust? It's a, you know, universal concept. Everyone wants to trust their computer. And right now, no one does trust their computer. Why? Because they always crash. So annoying. So you've got these paradoxes that I was discussing back in the beginning here, where trusted computing gives you these great new options. You've got this option of buying into the reusable proofs of work system. Now you don't have to be running trusted computing on your desktop for it, but you can tell people what software you're running and prove it to them, which has a lot of potential here. A great example of the remote attestation being useful is let's say your email server is running it, and it refuses to talk to your computer if your computer has been compromised. Now, this is good because maybe you don't want to make your own data on your desktop inaccessible to you on the off chance that the system breaks down somewhere. But you certainly wouldn't mind if your email server made it inaccessible to you, because you can always, you know, convince your system administrator that you fixed your computer, that you're happy with your new software configuration. So if you attest your computer here, your desktop, attests to your email server, look, I'm running the software that I was running last time I talked to you. And your email server will then be able to say, okay, I'll send you your email, which is really good if you get a lot of secrets in your email, because you wouldn't want the bad guys reading the emails you get from your girlfriend or from your boss, whatever it is. But the flip side of this is that you're decreasing your freedom with respect to all other kinds of data that might be sent to you through some essential network service. So if you reject trusted computing, which so far it looks like the world is doing, I can only think of one manufacturer of computer that comes with a trusted computing chip built in, at least a major manufacturer, and that's our friends IBM here again. This IBM doesn't, but a lot of the newer ones do. If we refuse it now, we can say, when people come around to us and say, we'd like to give you this media, but first we want to know what you're going to do with it. Trust that your computer is not going to copy it, make fun of it, share it with your friends. If we resist now, when trusted computing is only installed on a few systems, then we can nip it in the bud. But if we wait, we may not have that choice anymore. Thank you. Questions? Yes.
I think the trusted computing is already here, because the processors has the real mode and protection mode, and of course they have the system management mode, which can block access to the peripheral devices. Did you know that?
I've heard about this, but the thing about it is that it's all controlled by software, ultimately. And you control the software on your system. There's nothing on there that can't be modified by modifying the software, as far as I know. The processor ID on a Pentium. Remember that one? The Pentium 3 came with a processor ID, and everyone's like, oh no, they're going to violate my privacy, right? But what they neglected to notice was, how do you get access to that processor ID? Well, if someone over the internet wants to get access to it, they ask your computer for it, at which point your computer can tell them whatever it wants, because there's no secret inside your computer that gives you a route to trust.
Okay, I will return back to that problem, because the system management mode can be in separate address space, so it can be in some kind of chip, and you can't get rid of the code even if you are running, for example, some free operating system, because it will trigger the routines in that chip when you are trying to access the I/O ports. So it's very dangerous, and I think not many people know about this system management mode. So the trusted computing might begin with such small sneaky stuff.
Well, the interesting thing about that is that that's limited to the manufacturer of whatever software is running on that chip, right? That separate chip that's implementing system management mode. So now you're back to the model of a console where only a limited number of manufacturers can write software for it. Because if anyone can write software for it, then I can write software for it. And if I can write software for it, then I can make it do what I want. But if only a limited number of manufacturers can write software for it, then your computer is not a general purpose computer. And people have already shown that they really want general purpose computers, and they want computers that have a really wide range of software. That is, unfortunately, one of the major barriers to entry for GNU Linux systems, and also for Macintoshes. They just don't have the range of software, and so people reject them.
Okay, so that was, thank you very much. And anyone else here that wants to ask the question? Někdo se chce zeptat ještě? No, I think it's all. So thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.